14, ma'am. But she's a rare hand with cooking and sewing, clean in her person, and you'll never find a soul more biddable and willing. He stood behind his daughter, hands on her shoulders, gripped tight enough to show his knuckles white. His eyes met Brianna's. They were pale blue, pleading. His lips moved without sound, but she heard him clearly. "Please," he said. Beyond him, Brianna could see her uncle, who had come into the hall. He was talking to young Jamie, smooth head and curly, bent together in close conversation. In a moment, they would be looking for her. She took a deep breath and drew herself up to her full height. Well, and if you came right down to it, she thought, she was as much a Fraser as her cousin. Let them find out just how stubborn a rock could be. She smiled at the girl and held out a hand, offering the second uneaten bridie. It's a bargain, Lizzie. Will you have a bite to seal it? She's eaten my food, Brianna said, with as much assurance as she could conjure up. She's mine. Rather to her surprise, this statement finally put a stop to the argument. Her cousin looked as though he meant to go on remonstrating, but her uncle put a hand on young Jamie's arm to silence him. The look of surprise on Ian's face turned to a sort of amused respect. As she know. He looked at Lizzie cowering behind Brianna, and his lips twitched. Well then, not much more to be said, is there? Young Jamie evidently didn't share his father's assessment of this point. He could think of quite a lot more to be said. But a wee lassie like that, she's useless. He waved a dismissive hand at Lizzie, frowning. Why, she isn't big enough even to carry baggage, let alone...
I'm big enough to carry my own bags, thanks, Brianna put in.
She lowered her brows and gave her cousin back scowl for scowl, straightening up to emphasize her height. He lifted an eyebrow in acknowledgement, but didn't give up. A woman shouldn't be travelling alone.
I won't be alone. I'll have Lizzie.
And certainly not to a place like America. Why, it's... You'd think it was the ends of the earth to hear you talk. And you haven't even seen it, Brianna said in exasperation. I was born in America, for heaven's sake. Uncle and cousin gaped at her, identical expressions of shock on their faces. She seized the opportunity to press her advantage.
It's my money, and my servant, and my journey. I've given my word, and I'll keep it.
Ian rubbed a knuckle across his upper lip, suppressing a grin. He shook his head.
They say it's a wise bairn that kens its father, but I dinna think there's much doubt who yours is, lass. You might have the lang nebbit and red locks from anyone, but ye didna get the stubbornness from any man but Jamie Fraser.
A self-conscious flush rose to her cheeks, but Brianna felt an odd flutter of something like pleasure. His feathers ruffled from the argument, young Jamie made one last attempt.
It's very unseemly for a woman to be giving her opinions sae free, and her with menfolk to look after her, he said stiffly.
You don't think women ought to have opinions? Brianna asked sweetly.
No, I don't.
Ian gave his son a long look.
And you'll have been married, what, 8 years?
He shook his head.
Aye, well, your Joan's a tactful woman.
Ignoring young Jamie's black look, he turned back to Lizzie.
Very well, then. Go and take farewell of your father, lassie. I'll see to the papers.
He watched Lizzie scurry away, thin shoulders hunched against the crowd. He shook his head a little doubtfully and turned back to Brianna.
Well, she'll maybe be better company for you than a manservant, lass. But your cousin's right about the one thing. She'll be no protection. It'll be you looking out for her, likely.
Brianna straightened her shoulders and thrust out her chin, summoning up as much self-confidence as she could, in spite of the sudden hollow feeling that assailed her.
I can manage, she said.
She kept her hand curled tight, holding onto the stone in her palm. It was something to cling to as the Moray Firth widened into the sea and the cradling shore of Scotland fell away to either side. Why ought she feel so strongly for a place she hardly knew? Lizzie, born and raised in Scotland, had spared no glance for the receding land, but had gone below at once to lay claim to their space and arrange the few belongings they had brought aboard. Brianna had never thought of herself as Scottish, hadn't known she was Scottish until quite recently. Yet she had scarcely felt more bereft by her mother's leaving or her father's death than by this parting from people and places she had known for so short a time. Perhaps it was only the contagious emotion of the other passengers. Most of them were standing at the rail as she was, several weeping openly. Or fear of the long journey ahead. But she knew quite well it was none of those things.
"That's that, I expect."
It was Lizzie, appearing at her elbow after all, to see the last sight of the land fade away. Her small, pale face was expressionless, but Brianna didn't mistake lack of expression for lack of feeling.
"Yes, we're on our way."
Moved by impulse, Brianna put out a hand and drew the girl to stand in front of her at the rail, sheltered alike from freshening wind and from jostling passengers and seamen. Lizzie was a good foot shorter than Brianna, and fine-boned as the delicate sooty terns that circled the mast squawking overhead. The sun didn't really set at this time of year, but hung low above the dark hills, and the air had grown quite cold in the firth. The girl was thinly dressed. She shivered, and pressed quite unself-consciously against Brianna for warmth. Brianna had a blue woolen arasach, provided by Jenny. She wrapped her arms and the shawl ends around the younger girl, finding as much comfort in the embrace as she gave.
"It'll be all right," she said to herself as much as to Lizzie.
The pale blonde head bobbed briefly under her chin. She couldn't tell whether it was a nod or only Lizzie's attempt to get the wind-whipped strands of hair out of her eyes. Elf locks, snatched from her own thick plait, fluttered in the stiff salt breeze, echoing the pull of the huge sails above. Despite her misgivings, she felt her spirits start to rise with the wind. She had survived a good many partings so far. She would survive this. That was what made this leaving hard, she thought. She had already lost father, mother, lover, home, and friends. She was alone by necessity, and also by choice. But then, to find both home and family again so unexpectedly at Lallybroch had caught her unaware. She would have given almost anything to stay, just a little longer. But there were promises to keep, losses to be made good. Then she could come back, to Scotland, and to Roger. She shifted her arm, feeling his thin silver band warm on her wrist under the shawl, the metal heated by her own flesh. Un peu, beaucoup. Her other hand gripped the cloth together, exposed to the wind and damp with sea spray. If it hadn't been so cold, she mightn't have noticed the sudden warmth of the drop that fell on the back of her hand. Lizzie stood stiff as a stick, her arms hugged tight around herself. Her ears were large and transparent, her hair fine and thin, sleek to her skull. Her ears poked out like a mouse's. Brianna reached up and wiped away the tears by touch. Her own eyes were dry, and her mouth set firm as she looked out at the land over Lizzie's head. But the cold face and quivering lips against her hand might as well have been her own. They stood for some time silently until the last of the land was gone. Chapter 36. You can't go home again. Inverness, July 1769. Roger walked slowly through the town, looking around him with a mixture of fascination and delight. Inverness had changed a bit in 200-odd years, no doubt of it, and yet it was recognisably the same town. A good deal smaller, to be sure, with half its muddy streets unpaved, and yet he knew this street he was walking down, had walked down it 100 times before. It was Huntley Street, and while most of the small shops and buildings were unfamiliar, across the river stood the old high church, not so old now, its stubby steeple blunt as ever. Surely, if he went inside, Mrs. Dunvegan, the minister's wife, would be setting out flowers in the chancel, ready for the Sunday service. But she wouldn't. Mrs. Dunvegan hadn't happened yet, with her thick wool sweaters and the terrible pot pies with which she tormented the sick of her husband's parish. Yet the small stone kirk stood solid and familiar, in the charge of a stranger. His father's own church wasn't here. It had been, would be, built in 1837. Likewise, the manse, which had always seemed so elderly and decrepit, hadn't been built until the early 1900s. He had passed the site on his way. There was nothing there now save a tangle of cinquefoil and sweet broom, and a single small rowan sapling that sprouted from the underbrush, leaves fluttering in the light wind. There was the same damp coolness to the air, tingling with freshness, but the overlying stink of motor exhaust was gone, replaced by a distant reek of sewage. The most striking absence was the churches, where both banks of the river would one day sport a noble profusion of steeples and spires. Now there was nothing save a scatter of small buildings. There was only the one stone footbridge, but the River Ness itself was naturally much the same. The river was low, and the same gulls sat in the riffles, squawking companionably to one another as they picked small fish from among the stones just under the water's surface.
"Luck to you, mate,"
he said to a fat gull who sat on the bridge, and crossed the river into the town. Here and there a gracious residence sat comfortably insulated by its wide grounds, a grand lady spreading her skirts, ignoring the presence of a hoi polloi nearby. There was Mount Gerald in the distance, the big house looking precisely as he'd always known it, save that the great copper beeches that would in future surround the house hadn't yet been planted. Instead, a row of spindly Italian cypresses leaned dismally against the garden wall, looking homesick for their sunny birthplace. For all its elegance, Mount Gerald was reputed to have been built in the oldest of the old ways, with the foundation laid over the body of a human sacrifice. By report, a workman had been lured into the hole of the cellar, and a great stone dropped onto him from the top of the newly built wall, crushing him to death. He had, so local history said, been buried there in the cellar, his blood a propitiation to the hungry spirits of the earth, who, thus satisfied, had allowed the edifice to stand prosperous and untroubled through the years. The house could be no more than 20 or 30 years old now, Roger thought. There might easily be people in the town who had worked on its building, who knew exactly what had happened in that cellar, to whom and why. But he had other things to do. Mount Gerald and its ghost would have to keep their secrets. With a mild pang of regret, he left the big house behind and turned his scholar's nose into the road that led to the docks downriver. With a feeling of what could only be called déjà vu, he pushed open the door of a pub. The half-timbered entry, with its stone flags, was as he had seen it a week before, and 200 years hence. And the familiar smell of hops and yeast in the air was a comfort to his spirit. The name had changed, but not the smell of beer. Roger took a deep gulp from his wooden cup and nearly choked.
"All right, man."
The barman paused, a bucket of sand in his hand, to peer at Roger.
"Fine," Roger said hoarsely. "Just fine."
The barman nodded and went back to scattering sand, but kept a practiced eye on Roger in case he looked like vomiting on the freshly swept and sanded floor. Roger coughed and cleared his throat, then essayed a further cautious sip. The flavour was fine, very good, in fact. It was the alcohol content that was unexpected. This stuff packed a wallop far greater than any modern beer Roger had ever encountered. Claire had said that alcoholism was endemic to the time, and Roger could easily see why. Still, if drunkenness were the greatest hazard he faced, he could deal with that. He sat quietly by the hearth and drank, savouring the dark, bitter brew as he watched and listened. It was a port pub, and a busy one. So near the docks on the Moray Firth, it hosted sea captains and merchants, as well as sailors from the ships in port, and longshoremen and labourers from the nearby warehouses. A great deal of business of one kind and another was being transacted over the beer-stained surfaces of its many small tables. With half an ear, Roger could hear a contract being arranged for the shipping of 300 bolts of cheap drugget cloth from Aberdeen, bound for the colonies, with an exchange to be made for a cargo of rice and indigo from the Carolinas. 100 head of Galloway cattle, 600 weight of rolled copper, casks of sulphur, molasses, and wine. Quantities and prices, delivery dates and conditions floated through the babble and beer fumes of the pub like the thick blue clouds of tobacco smoke that floated near the low ceiling beams. Not only goods were being bargained for. In one corner sat a ship's captain, marked by the cut of his long, full-skirted coat and the fine black tricorn that lay on the table by his elbow. He was attended by a clerk, a ledger, and a money box on the table before him, interviewing a steady stream of people, emigrants seeking passage to the colonies for themselves and their families. Roger watched the proceedings covertly. The ship was bound for Virginia, and after listening for some time, he deduced that the cost of passage for a male passenger, for a gentleman, that is, was £10, 8 shillings. Those willing to travel in the steerage, packed like casks and cattle in the lower holds, might ship aboard for £4, 2 shillings each, bringing their own food for a 6 weeks' voyage. Fresh water, he gathered, was provided. For those desiring passage but lacking funds, there were other means available.
"Indenture meant for yourself, your wife, and your 2 elder sons."
The captain tilted his head appraisingly, looking over the family that stood before him. A small, wiry man, who might be in his early 30s but looked much older, shabby and bowed with labour. His wife, perhaps a little younger, standing behind her husband, eyes glued to the floor, tightly grasping the hands of 2 little girls. One of the girls held on to her baby brother, a lad of 3 or 4. The elder boys stood by their father, trying to look manly. Roger thought they might be 10 and 12, allowing for the puny stature caused by malnutrition.
"Yourself and the boys, aye, that'll do," the captain said.
He frowned at the woman, who didn't look up.
"No one will buy a woman with so many young ones. She might keep one, perhaps. You'll have to sell the girls, though."
The man glanced back at his family. His wife kept her head down, unmoving, not looking at anything. One of the girls twitched and jerked, though, complaining in an undertone that her hand was being crushed. The man turned back.
"All right," he said, low-voiced. "Can they, might they, go together?"
The captain rubbed a hand across his mouth and nodded indifferently.
"Likely enough."
Roger didn't wait to witness the details of the transaction. He got up abruptly and left the pub. The dark beer had lost its taste. He paused in the street outside, fingering the coins in his pocket. It was all he had been able to collect of suitable money in the time he'd had. He had thought that it would be enough, though. He was good-sized and had a fair amount of confidence in his own abilities. Still, the little scene he had witnessed in the pub had shaken him. He had grown up with the history of the Highlands. He knew well enough the sorts of things that drove family to such a pitch of desperation that they would accept permanent separation and semi-slavery as the price of survival. He knew all about the sale of lands that forced small crofters off the lands their families had tended for hundreds of years, all about the dreadful conditions of penury and starvation in the cities, the simple insupportableness of life in Scotland in these days. And not all his years of reading and study had prepared him for the look of that woman's face, her eyes fixed on the fresh sanded floor, her daughter's hands clutched hard in her own.
£10, 8 shillings, or £4, 2, plus whatever it might cost for food.
He had exactly 14 shillings, 3 pence in his pocket, together with a handful of copper doits and a couple of farthings. He walked slowly down the lane that led along the seaside, glancing at the collection of ships that lay moored by the wooden docks. Fishing catches for the most part, small galleys and brigs that plied their trade up and down the Firth, or at most ran across the channel, carrying cargo and passengers to France. Only 3 large ships lay at anchor in the Firth, those of a size to brave the winds of the Atlantic crossing. He could cross to France, of course, and take ship from there, or travel overland to Edinburgh, a much larger port than Inverness. But it would be late in the year then for sailing. Brianna was 6 weeks before him already. He could waste no time in finding her. God knew what could happen to a woman alone here.
£4 2 shillings.
Well, he could work, certainly. With neither children nor wife to support, he could save most of his earnings. But given that the average clerk earned something like £12 per year, and that he was much more likely to find work shovelling stables than keeping accounts, the chances of his saving up passage money in any reasonable time were fairly slim.
"First things first," he muttered. "Be sure where she's gone before you trouble about getting there yourself."
Taking his hand out of his pocket, he turned right between two warehouses and into a narrow lane. His high spirits of the morning had largely evaporated, but they lifted slightly, nonetheless, when he saw that he had been right in his guess. The harbour master's office was where he had known it must be, in the same squat stone building where it still would be 200 years hence. Roger smiled with wry humour. Scots weren't inclined to make changes purely for the sake of change. It was crowded and busy inside, with four harried clerks behind a battered wooden counter, scribbling and stamping, carrying bundles of paper to and fro, taking money and conveying it carefully into an inner office, from which they issued moments later, bearing receipts on japanned tin trays. A crush of impatient men pressed against the counter, each endeavouring to signal by means of voice and posture that his business was much more urgent than that of the fellow standing next to him. Once Roger had succeeded in capturing the attention of one of the clerks, though, there turned out to be no great difficulty in seeing the registers of the ships that had sailed from Inverness within the last few months.
"Here, wait," he said to the young man, who pushed a large leather-bound book across the counter to him.
"Aye."
The clerk was flushed with hurry and had a smut of ink on his nose, but paused politely, arrested in flight.
"How much do you get paid for working here?" Roger asked.
The clerk's fair eyebrows lifted, but he was in too much hurry either to ask questions or to take offence at the inquiry.
"6 shillings the week," he said briefly,
and promptly disappeared in response to an irritable shout of "Munro!" from the office beyond the counter.
"Mm-hmm."
Roger pushed back through the crowd and took the book of registers away to a small table by the window, out of the main stream of traffic. Having seen the conditions under which the clerks worked, Roger was impressed at the legibility of the handwritten registers. He was well accustomed to archaic spelling and eccentric punctuation, though those he was used to seeing were always yellowed and fragile, on the verge of disintegration. It gave him an odd little historian's thrill to see the page before him fresh and white, and just beyond, the clerk, who sat at a high table, copying as fast as quill could write, shoulders hunched against the hubbub in the room.
"You're shilly-shallying," said a cold little voice in the middle of his brain. "She's here, or she's not. Being afraid to look won't change it. Get on."
Roger took a deep breath and flipped open the big ledger book. The ship's names were neatly lettered at the tops of pages, followed by the names of their masters and mates, their main cargoes, and dates of sailing. Ariana, Polyphemus, Merry Widow, Tiburon. Despite his apprehensions, he couldn't help admiring the names of the ships as he thumbed through the pages. Half an hour later, he had ceased to marvel over both poetry and picturesqueness, barely noting each ship's name as he ran his finger down the pages in increasing desperation. Not here. She wasn't here. But she had to be, he argued with himself. She had to have taken a ship to the colonies. Where else could she bloody be? Unless she hadn't found the notice after all. But the sick feeling under his ribs assured him that she had. Nothing else would have made her risk the stones. He took a deep breath and closed his eyes, which were starting to feel the strain of the handwritten pages. Then he opened his eyes, turned back to the first relevant register, and began to read again, doggedly muttering each name beneath his breath to be sure of not missing one out.
"Mr. Phineas Forbes, gentlemen. Mrs. Wilhelmina Forbes. Master Joshua Forbes. Mrs. Josephine Forbes.
Mrs. Eglantine Forbes, Mrs. Charlotte Forbes. He smiled to himself at the thought of Mr. Phineas Forbes surrounded by his womenfolk. Even knowing that Mrs. here was sometimes merely the abbreviated form of mistress, and thus used for both married and unmarried women, rather than the Miss for little girls, he found himself with an irresistible mental picture of Phineas marching stoutly aboard at the head of a train of four wives, Master Joshua no doubt bringing up the rear. Mr. William Talbot, merchant. Mr. Peter Talbot, merchant. Mr. Jonathan Bicknell, physician. Mr. Robert MacLeod, farmer. Mr. Gordon MacLeod, farmer. Mr. Martin MacLeod. No Randalls this time through either. Not for the Persephone, the Queen's Revenge, or the Phoebe. He rubbed his aching eyes and began on the register of the Philip Alonso. A Spanish name, but it was listed under Scottish registry. Sailing from Inverness under the command of Captain Patrick O'Brien. He hadn't given up, but had already begun to think what to do next if she shouldn't be listed in the registers. Lallybroch, of course. He'd been there once in his own time, to the abandoned remains of the estate. Could he find it now, without the guidance of roads and signposts? His thoughts stopped with a jolt as his gliding finger came to a halt near the bottom of a page. Not Brianna Randall, not the name he'd been looking for, but a name that rang bells of recognition in his mind. Fraser, read the slanted, crisp black writing. Mr. Brian Fraser. No, not Brian. And not Mr. either. He bent closer, squinting at the cramped black lettering. He closed his eyes, feeling his heart thump hard in his chest, and relief flowed through him, intoxicating as the pub's special dark beer. Mrs., not Mr. And what had first seemed merely an exuberant tale on the end of Brian was, on closer inspection, almost surely instead a careless A. Her. It was her. It had to be. It was an unusual first name. He had seen no other Briannas or Briannas anywhere in the massive register. And even Fraser made sense, of a sort. Embarked on a quixotic quest to find her father, she had taken his name, the name she was entitled to by right of birth. He slammed the register closed, as though to keep her from escaping from the pages, and sat for a moment, breathing. Got her! He saw the fair-haired clerk eyeing him curiously from the counter, and, flushing, opened the book again. The Philip Alonso sailed from Inverness on the 4th of July, Anno Domini 1769, for Charleston, South Carolina. He frowned at the name, suddenly uncertain. South Carolina? Was that her real destination, or only as close as she could get? A quick glance at the rest of the registers showed no ships in July for North Carolina. Perhaps she'd simply taken the first ship for the southern colonies, intending to journey overland. Or maybe he was wrong. A chill gripped him that had nothing to do with the river wind seeping through the cracks of the window next to him. He looked at the page again and was reassured. No, there was no profession given as there was for all the men. It was certainly Mrs. And therefore it must be Brianna as well. And if Brianna it was, then Brianna it was too. He knew it. He rose and handed the book across the counter to his fair-haired acquaintance. "Thanks, man," he said, relaxing into his own soft accent. "Can you be telling me, is there a ship in port bound for the American colonies soon now?" "Oh, aye," the clerk said, deftly stowing the register with one hand and accepting a bill of lading from a customer with the other. "Happen it'll be the Gloriana. She sails day after tomorrow for the Carolinas." He looked Roger up and down. "Emigrant or seaman?" he asked. "Seaman," Roger said promptly. Ignoring the other's raised eyebrow, he waved toward the forest of masts visible through the paned windows. "Where do I go to sign on?" Both eyebrows high, the clerk nodded in the direction of the door. "Her master works from the Friars when he's in port. Likely he'll be there now. Captain Bonnet." He forbore adding what was obvious from his sceptical expression, if Roger was a seaman, he, the clerk, was an African parrot.
Right, Muyilia. Thanks.
Sketching a salute, Roger turned away, but turned back at the door to find the clerk still watching him, ignoring the press of impatient customers.
Wish me luck, Roger called with a grin.
The clerk's answering grin was tinged with something that might have been either admiration or wistfulness.
Luck to you, man, he called,
and waved in farewell. By the time the door swung shut, he was deep in conversation with the next customer, quill pen poised in readiness. He found Captain Bonnet in the pub, as advertised, settled in a corner under a thick blue haze of smoke, to which the captain's own cigar was adding.
Your name?
Mackenzie,
Roger said on sudden impulse. If Brianna could do it, so could he.
Mackenzie? Any experience, Mr. Mackenzie?
A bar of sunlight cut across the captain's face, making him squint. Bonnet drew back into the shadow of the settle, and the lines around his eyes relaxed, leaving Roger exposed to a gaze of uncomfortable penetration.
It is myself has fished the herring now and then in the Minch.
It was no lie at that. He'd had several teenaged summers as hand on a herring boat, captained by an acquaintance of the Reverend's. The experience had left him with a useful layer of muscle, an ear for the sing-song cadence of the Isles, and a fixed dislike of herring. But he knew the feel of a rope in his hands, at least.
Aye, you're a good-sized lad, but a fisherman will not be the same as a sealer, sure.
The man's soft Irish lilt left it open whether this was a question, statement, or provocation.
I shouldn't have thought it an occupation requiring great skill.
For no reason he could name, Captain Bonnet raised the hairs on the back of his neck. The green eyes sharpened.
Perhaps more than you think. But sure, it's nothing a willing man can't learn. But what would it be now that makes a fellow of your sort crave the sea of a sudden?
The eyes flickered in the tavern shadows, taking him in.
Of your sort? What was it, Roger wondered. Not his speech. He'd taken care to suppress any hint of the Oxford scholar by taking on the tuchtre cant of the Isles. Was he too well dressed for a would-be sailor? Or was it the singed collar and the burn mark on the breast of his coat? That will be none of your business, I'm thinking, he answered evenly.
With a minor effort, he kept his hands relaxed at his sides. The pale green eyes studied him dispassionately, unblinking. Like a leopard watching a passing wildebeest, Roger thought, wondering whether it would be worth the chase. The heavy lids dropped.
Not worth it.
For the moment.
You'll be aboard by sundown, Bonnet said. 5 shillings the month. Meet 3 days in the week, plumbed off on Sundays. You'll have a hammock, but find your own clothes. You'll be free to leave the ship once the cargo is unloaded. Not until that time. We are agreed, sir.
It is agreed, Roger said,
suddenly dry-mouthed.
He would have given a lot for a pint, but not now, not here, under that pale green gaze. Ask for Mr. Dixon when you come aboard. He's paymaster.
Bonnet leaned back, took a small leather-bound book from his pocket, and flipped it open. Audience concluded. Roger turned smartly and went out without a backward glance. There was a small cold spot at the base of his skull. If he looked back, he knew he would see that lucent green gaze fixed unwaveringly over the edge of the unread book, taking note of every weakness.
The cold spot, he thought, was where the teeth would meet.
Chapter 37. Gloriana. Before shipping with the Gloriana, Roger had assumed himself to be in reasonably good condition. In fact, compared to most of the obviously malnourished and wizened specimens of humanity who constituted the rest of the crew, he considered himself well endowed indeed. It took precisely 14 hours, the length of one day's work, to disabuse him of this notion. Blisters he had bargained for, and sore muscles. Heaving crates, lifting spars, and hauling ropes were familiar labour, though he hadn't done it for some time. What he had forgotten was the bone-deep fatigue that sprang as much from the constant chill of damp clothes as from the work. He welcomed the heavy labour in the cargo hold because it warmed him temporarily, even though he knew the warmth would be succeeded by a fine, constant shiver as soon as he emerged on deck, where the wind could resume its icy probe of his sweat-soaked clothes. Hands roughened and scraped by wet hemp were painful, but expected. By the end of the first day, his palms were black with tar, and the skin of his fingers cracked and bled at the joints, scraped raw. But the gnawing ache of hunger had been something of a surprise. He hadn't thought it possible to be as hungry as he was. The knobbled lump of humanity working beside him, one Duff by name, was similarly damp, but seemed unfazed by the condition. The long pointed nose that quested, ferret-like, from the upturned collar of a ragged jacket was blue at the tip, and dripped regularly as a stalactite. But the pale eyes were sharp, and the mouth beneath grinned wide, displaying teeth the colour of the water in the firth.
"Take heart, man, grubbin' twa bells."
Duff gave him a companionable elbow in the ribs and disappeared nimbly down a hatchway, from whose cavernous recesses echoed blasphemous shouts and loud bangings. Roger resumed his unloading of the cargo net, heartened indeed at the prospect of supper. The afterhold had already been half-filled. The water casks were loaded, tier upon tier of wooden hogsheads, squatting in the shadowy gloom, each 100-gallon cask weighing more than 700 pounds. But the forward hold still gaped empty, and a constant procession of loaders and keymen streamed like ants across the dock, piling up such a heap of boxes and barrels, rolls and bundles, that it seemed inconceivable that the mass should ever be condensed sufficiently to fit within the ship. It took 2 days to finish the loading. Barrels of salt, bolts of cloth, huge crates of ironmongery that had to be lowered with rope slings because of their weight. It was here that Roger's size proved of benefit. At the end of a rope belayed around the capstan, he leaned back against the weight of a crate suspended at the other end, and, muscles popping with the strain, lowered it slowly enough that the two men below could catch and guide it into place in the increasingly crowded hold. The passengers came aboard in the late afternoon, a straggling line of emigrants, burdened with bags, bundles, caged chickens, and children. These were the cargo of the steerage. A space created by erection of a bulkhead across the forward hold, and as profitable in their way as the harder goods aft.
"Bondsmen and redemptioners,"
Dufford told him, looking over the incomers with a practised eye.
"Worth £15 each on the hoof in the plantations. Wains 3 or 4. Bairns at the teat go free with their mothers."
The seaman coughed, a deep rattling noise like an ancient motor starting up, and hawked a gob of phlegm, narrowly missing the side rail as he spat. He shook his head as he looked the shuffling line over.
"Happen some can pee their way, but no many in this lot. They'll have had a job to come up with £12 a family for their feed on the voyage."
"The captain doesn't feed them, then?"
"Oh, aye."
Duff rumbled in his chest again, coughed and spat.
"For a price."
He grinned at Roger, wiped his mouth, and jerked his head toward the gangplank.
"Go and lend a hand, laddie. We wouldn't want the captain's profit to be falling into the water now, would we?"
Surprised by the padded feel of a little girl as he swung her aboard, Roger looked closer and saw that the stout build of many of the women was illusion, occasioned by their wearing several layers of clothes, all they owned in the world, apparently. Beyond small bundles of personal possessions, boxes of food put by for the journey, and the scrawny children for whose sake they took this desperate step. Roger squatted, smiling at a reluctant toddler who clung to his mother's skirts. He was no more than 2, still in smocks, with a riot of soft blonde curls, his fat little mouth drawn down in fearful disapproval of everything around him.
"Come on, man,"
Roger said softly, putting out a hand in invitation. It was no longer an effort to control his accent. His usual clipped Oxbridge had eluded to the gentler Highland speech with which he had grown up, and he used it now without conscious thought.
Your mam canna be picking you up now. You come with me.
Grossly mistrustful, the boy snuffled and glowered at him, but suffered him to peel the grubby little fingers away from his mother's skirts. Roger carried the little boy across the deck, the woman following him silently. She looked up at him as he handed her down the ladder, her eyes fixed on his. Her face disappeared in the darkness like a white rock dropped down a well, and he turned away with a feeling of unease, as though he had abandoned someone to drowning. As he turned back to his work, he saw a young woman just coming down above the quay. She was the sort of girl called Bonnie, not beautiful, but lively and nicely made, with something about her that took the eye. Perhaps it was only her posture, straight as a lily stem among the hunched and drooping backs around her, or her face, which showed apprehension and uncertainty, but had still about it the brightness of curiosity.
"Adira, that one," he thought,
and his heart, oppressed by so many downcast faces among the emigrants, lightened at the sight of her. She hesitated at the sight of the ship and the crowd around it. A tall, fair-haired young man was with her, a baby in his arms. He touched her shoulder in reassurance, and she glanced up at him, an answering smile lighting her face like the striking of a match. Watching them, Roger felt a mild pang of something that might have been envy.
"You! Mackenzie!"
The bosun's shout pulled him from his contemplation. The bosun jerked his head aft.
"There's cargo awaiting. It's not going to walk aboard by itself."
Once embarked and under sail, the voyage went smoothly for some weeks. The stormy weather that accompanied their exodus from Scotland quickly diminished into good winds and rolling seas. And while the immediate effect of this on the passengers was to make the majority of them seasick, this ailment also faded in time. The smell of vomit from the steerage subsided, becoming only a minor note in the symphony of stinks aboard the Gloriana. Roger had been born with an acute sense of smell, an attribute he was finding a marked liability in close quarters. Still, even the keenest nose grew accustomed in time, and within a day or so he had ceased to note any but the most novel stenches. He was fortunately not subject to seasickness himself, though his experiences with the herring fishers had been enough to give him a keen appreciation of the weather, with the sailor's unsettling knowledge that his life might depend on whether the sun was shining that day. His new shipmates weren't friendly, but neither were they hostile. Whether it was his Tuchter accent from the Isles, for most of the Gloriana's hands were English speakers from Dingwall or Peterhead, the occasional odd things that he'd said, or simply his size, they regarded him with a certain watchful distance. No overt antagonism. His size prevented that, but distance nonetheless. Roger wasn't disturbed by the coolness. He was pleased enough to be left to his thoughts, his mind ranging free while his body dealt with a daily round of shipboard duties. There was plenty to think about. He had taken no heed to the reputation of the Gloriana or her captain before signing on. He would have sailed with Captain Ahab, provided only that that gentleman was bound for North Carolina. Still, from the talk he heard among the crew, he gathered that Stephen Bonnet was known as a good captain, hard but fair, and a man whose voyages always turned a profit. To the seamen, many of whom sailed on shares rather than wages, this latter quality plainly more than compensated for any small defects of character or address. Not that Roger had seen open evidence of such defects, but he did see that Bonnet stood always as though an invisible circle had been drawn around him, a circle that few were bold enough to enter. Only the first mate and the bosun spoke directly to the captain. The crewmen kept their heads down as he passed. Roger remembered the cool green leopard eyes that had looked him over. Little wonder that no one wanted to attract their notice. He was more interested in the passengers, though, than in either crew or captain. Little was seen of them normally, but they were allowed on deck briefly twice each day, to take a bit of air, to empty their slop jars over the side, for the ship's heads were woefully inadequate for so many, and to carry down again the small amounts of water carefully rationed to each family. Roger looked forward to these brief appearances, and tried to see to it that he was employed as often as possible near the end of the deck where they took their fleeting exercise. His interest was both professional and personal. His historian's instincts were roused by their presence, and his loneliness soothed by the homeliness of their talk. Here were the seeds of the new country, the legacy of the old. What these poor emigrants knew and valued was what would endure to be passed on. If one were hand-picking the repository of Scottish culture, he thought, it might not contain such things as a recipe for warts, about which an elderly woman was berating her long-suffering daughter-in-law. "I did tell you, Katie Mac, and why you choose to leave my nice dried toddy behind when you could find room to bring all yon rubbish that we be squatting on and picking out from under our hurdies day and night." But that would last, too, right along with the folk songs and prayers, with the woven wool and the Celtic patterns of their art. He glanced at his own hand. He vividly remembered Mrs. Graham rubbing a large wart on his third finger with what she said was a dried toad. He grinned, rubbing a thumb across the spot. Must have worked. He'd never had another.
"Sir," said a small voice by his side, "Sir, may we go and touch the iron?"
He glanced down and smiled at the tiny girl, holding two tinier brothers by their hands.
"Aye, Aliannon," he said. "Get on. Yourself will be minding the men, though."
She nodded, and the three of them pattered off, looking anxiously up and down to be sure they weren't in the way, before scrambling up to touch the horseshoe nailed to the mast for luck. Iron was protection and healing. The mothers often sent the little ones who were ailing to touch it.
They could have used iron to better effect internally, Roger thought, seeing the rash on the pasty white faces and hearing the high-pitched complaints of itching boils, of loose teeth and fever.
He resumed his job, measuring out water by the dipperful into the buckets and dishes the emigrants held out to him. They were living on oatmeal, the lot of them. That, with dried peas now and then and a bit of hard biscuit, was the sum total of the provisions supplied them for the voyage. At that, he'd heard no complaint. The water was clean, the biscuit wasn't mouldy, and if the allowance of corn wasn't generous, neither was it niggardly. The crew was fed better, but still on meat and starch, with only the occasional onion for relief. He ran his tongue round his teeth, testing as he did every few days. The faint taste of iron was nearly always in his mouth now. His gums were beginning to bleed from the lack of fresh vegetables. Still, his teeth were strongly rooted, and he had no sign of the swollen joints or bruised nails that several of the other crewmen showed. He'd looked it up during his weeks of waiting. A normal adult male in good health should be able to endure from 3 to 6 months of prolonged vitamin deficiency before suffering any real symptoms. If the good weather held, they'd be across in only 2.
"It will be good weather tomorrow, aye?"
His attention recalled by this apparent reading of his thoughts, he looked down to find it was the bonny brown-haired girl he'd admired on the quay in Inverness. Morag, her friends called her.
"I'm hoping it may be," he said, taking her bucket with an answering smile. "Why do you say so?"
She nodded, pointing over his shoulder with a small, sharp chin.
"There's the new moon in the arms of the old. If that means fine weather on the land, I should think it is the same on the sea, no?"
He glanced back to see the pale, clean curve of a silver moon holding a glowing orb in its cup. It rode high and perfect in an endless evening sky of pale violet, its reflection swallowed by the indigo sea.
"Dinna be wasting time chattering, lass. Go on and ask him."
He turned back in time to hear this hissed over Morag's shoulder by the middle-aged woman behind her. Morag glared back.
"Will you hush?" she hissed back. "I'll not. I said I won't." "You're a stubborn lass, Morag," the older woman declared, stepping boldly forward. "And if you will na be asking for yourself, I shall do it for you."
The good lady laid a broad hand on Roger's arm and gave him a charming smile.
"And what might your name be, lad?"
"Mackenzie, ma'am," Roger said respectfully, holding back a smile.
"Ah, Mackenzie, is it? Well, there you see, Morag. And belike he'll be some kinsman of your man's, and happy to do ye a service at that."
The woman turned triumphantly to the girl, then swung back to let Roger have the full force of her personality.
"She's suckling a wean and dying a thirst in the doing of it. A woman needs to drink when she's giving suck, or her milk dries. Everyone kens that well enough. But the silly lass canna bring herself to ask ye for a bitty more water. There's nane here grudge it to her, is there?"
she demanded rhetorically, turning round to glare at the other women in the line. Not surprisingly, all the heads shook back and forth like clockwork toys. It was getting dark, but Morag's face was visibly pink. Lips pressed tight together, she accepted the brimming bucket of water with a brief bob of her head.
"I thank you, Mr. Mackenzie," she murmured.
She didn't look up until she had reached the hatchway, but then she stopped and looked back over her shoulder at him, with a smile of such gratitude that he felt himself grow warm in spite of the sharp evening wind that blew through his shirt and jacket. He was sorry to see the waterline finish and the emigrants go below, the hatch battened down over them for the night watches. He knew they told stories and sang songs to pass the time, and would have given much to hear them. Not only from curiosity, but from longing. What moved him was neither pity for their poverty, nor thought of their uncertain future. It was envy of the sense of connection among them. But the captain, the crew, the passengers, even the all-important weather, occupied no more than a fragment of Roger's thoughts. What he thought about, day and night, wet or dry, hungry or fed, was Brianna. He went down to the mess when the signal came for supper, and ate without much noticing the contents of his trencher. His was the second watch. He went to his hammock after eating, choosing solitude and rest over the possibility of companionship on the forecastle. Solitude was an illusion, of course. Swinging gently in his hammock, he could feel each twitch and turn of the man next to him, the sweating heat of steeping flesh clammy against his own through the thick cotton mesh. Each man had 18 inches of sleeping space to call his own, and Roger was uncomfortably aware that when he lay upon his back, his shoulders exceeded that allowance by a good 2 inches on either side. After 2 nights of sleep, interrupted by the bumps and muttered insults of his shipmates, he had swapped places and ended in the space next to the bulkhead, where he would have only one companion to discommode. He learned to lie on one side, his face an inch or two from the wooden partition, back turned to his companions, and tune his ears to the sounds of the ship, blocking out the noises of the men around him. A very musical thing was a ship, lines and hawsers singing in the wind, the timber knees creaking with each rise and fall, the faint thumps and murmurs on the far side of the bulkhead, in the dark recesses of the passenger's hold in the steerage. He stared at the dark wood, lit by the shadows of the swinging lantern overhead, and began to recreate her, the lines of face and hair and body, all vivid in the dark. Too vivid. He could conjure her face without difficulty. What lay behind it was a good deal harder. Rest was also an illusion. When she had gone through the stone, she had taken with her all peace of mind. He lived in a mixture of fear and anger, spiced with the hurt of betrayal, rubbed like pepper into the wounds. The same questions ran round and round inside his mind without answers, a snake chasing its tail. Why had she gone? What was she doing? Why didn't she tell him? It was the effort to come up with an answer to the first of these that kept him going over and over it, as though the answer might afford him the key to the whole mystery of Brianna. Yeah, he'd been lonely, knew bloody well what it felt like to have no one in the world who belonged to you, or you to them. But surely that was one reason why they'd reached out to each other, he and Brianna. Claire knew, too, he thought suddenly. She'd been orphaned, lost her uncle, of course, she'd been married then, But she'd been separated from her husband during the war. Yes, she knew a lot about being alone. And that was why she'd taken care not to leave Bree alone, to assure herself that her daughter was loved.
Well, he tried to love her properly. Was still trying, he thought grimly, twisting uncomfortably in his hammock.
During the day, the demands of work suppressed the growing needs of his body.
At night, though, she was a deal too vivid, the Brianna of his memory.
He hadn't hesitated. He'd known from the first moment of realization that he must follow her. Sometimes, though, he wasn't sure whether he had come to save her or to savage her. Anything, so long as it was settled once and for all between them. He'd said he'd wait, but he'd waited long enough. The worst of it wasn't the loneliness, he thought, flinging restlessly over again, but the doubt. Doubt of her feelings and of his. Panic that he didn't truly know her. For the first time since his passage through the stones, he realized what she had meant in refusing him, and knew her hesitance for wisdom.
But was it wisdom, and not only fear?
If she hadn't gone through the stones, would she have turned to him at last wholeheartedly? Or turned away, always looking for something else? It was a leap of faith to throw one's heart across a gulf and trust another to catch it. His own was still in flight across the void, but with no certainty of landing, but still in flight. The sounds on the other side of the bulkhead had faded to silence, but now they started up again, in a stealthy, rhythmic fashion with which he was thoroughly familiar. They were at it again, whoever they were. They did it almost every night, when the others had gone to sleep. At first, the sounds had made him feel only his isolation, alone with the burning ghost of Brianna. There seemed no possibility of true human warmth, no joining of heart or mind, no more than the animal consolation of a body to cling to in the dark. Was there really any more for a man than this? But then he began to hear something else in the sounds. Half-caught words of tenderness, small furtive sounds of affirmation that made him in some way not a voyeur, but a participant in their joining. He couldn't tell, of course. It might have been any of the couples, or a random pairing of lust. And yet he put faces to them, this unknown pair. In his mind, he saw the tall, fair-haired young man, the brown-haired lass with the open face, saw them look at each other as they had on the quay, and would have sold his soul to know such certainty. Chapter 38 For Those in Peril on the Sea. A sudden hard squall kept the passengers below decks for 3 days, and the sailors at their posts with no more than scant minutes snatched for rest or food. At the end of it, when the Gloriana rode high on the dying storm swell, and the dawn sky was filled with racing mares' tails, Roger staggered down to his hammock, too exhausted even to shuck his wet clothes. Crumpled, damp, crusted with salt, and feeling fit for nothing but a hot bath and another week's sleep, he answered the bosun's whistle for the afternoon watch after 4 hours' rest, and staggered through his duties. He was so tired by sunset that his muscles quivered as he helped to heave up a fresh water barrel from the hold. He caved in the top with a hatchet, thinking that he might just manage the exertion of ladling out water rations without falling head first into the barrel. Then again, he might not. He splashed a cool handful of the fresh water into his face in hopes of soothing his burning eyes, and gulped down a whole dipperful, ignoring for once the strictures imposed by that constant contradiction of the sea. Always too much water and too little. The folk bringing up their jars and buckets to be filled looked as though they felt even worse than he did, green-gilled as mushrooms, bruised from being pitched to and fro in the hold like billiard balls, reeking of renewed seasickness and overflowing chamber pots. In marked contrast to the general air of pallid malaise, one of his old acquaintances was skipping in rings around him, singing in a monotonous chant that grated on his ears.
Seven herrings are a salmon's fill. Seven salmon are a sea's fill. Seven seas are a whale's fill. And seven whales the fill of a Keithan croon.
Bubbling with the freedom of release from the hold, the little girl hopped around like a demented chickadee, making Roger smile in spite of his tiredness. She hopped